Good morning. Good afternoon. It's afternoon. Good afternoon, Greenbelt. A little more energy. Good afternoon. Oh, that's lovely. How many of you are having a good time at Greenbelt this year? I love the Eucharist, the celebration. This is my, I think if I'm correct, my sixth time over 20 years of being here. And this is always a very special place for me. And so I'm very grateful to be with you. One of the best parts of Greenbelt is getting to meet new friends. And so before I say anything, I'd like you to turn and do two things. Meet somebody new and tell them why in the world you're at this session. This puzzles me because when I speak in Greenbelt or when I speak in the UK, community is not a hot topic here. So I really want to find out why you're in this session because I didn't expect this. I was meeting with Livability Group because my wife and I are going to be back last week in October to be with them. And they said in the universities here, this was new information, I'm always learning. In the universities here, when you sign up, you have your own private room. Unheard of in America. You always have two or three mates. And they said, impossible, not in Britain ever. People value privacy and seclusion and single. Do you know what I'm talking about? So I'm going to kind of ask us to shift our sight a bit in terms of that. But meet somebody next to you and ask them, why are you in this session? Because I want to find out in a minute. Okay? So meet somebody that you don't know. Okay, here we go. Did you meet some new mates, some new friends? Wonderful. Why are you here? I'm puzzled because community is not a topic that people normally in Britain want to talk about. Obviously, you have good community here, but we're talking about something a little different. Why are you here? Just, yes, please. You want to have a community? You do have one. How many of you, you have one?
He wants to know how to challenge to have one.
Okay. Let me just ask, are any of you here living in a residential community? There's a whole spectrum. One, two, three. Oh, that's very good news. Jesus Army people? No? Where's your community?
We live in Uxbridge in West London near Heathrow Airport. And just for ourselves, I've read your book. I've heard you speak before. I've been very inspired. And so I invited some friends and a few other people to live with me to be a community together.
Wonderful. And how many are three? Four. Okay. Who else is presently living in community? Okay.
I live with five people. We share cooking, share assets and stuff, living in houses. It's a good way to live.
Yeah. Okay. Christine and I live in a community on three floors. Eliasine Rosario Cruz that's here, he and his three wife and three kids live above us. The basement unit is open right now, but we do community on three floors. My wife is a keen gardener, and we grow 40% of our veg on an urban lot, do morning and evening prayers 4 days a week, but we're still just trying to find our way. Others of you, how many are interested in considering residential community in the future? Okay, at the end, I'm going to ask you all to come up to the stage so you can meet each other and start to network. I'm serious. Got to get something stirring. So if you're ready for that, well, let me just give you a little background. Coming to Britain, for me, is always like coming home. I've been coming for over 30 years, and I have so many good friends here, like Mark in this corner and Tony and some others. It's also home because part of my people come from Stanhope. You call it Stanhope, up by Durham. They were border people, and they're in the Anglican Cemetery. Raines is the family name, R-A-I-N-E-S. And so I just feel a real connectedness. Iona is a spiritual home for us. I took my first pilgrimage in 82, and we're very drawn to Celtic spirituality. I'll be talking in a minute because we're trying to start a Celtic eco village on 40 acres on an island north of Seattle that has something of the flavor of the Celtic tradition. So it's just very good to be back, and I'm particularly indebted to the young leaders in the UK. I found more creativity, initiative, and risk-taking among the young and creative in terms of the emerging church, the missional church, the new monasticism here than any place else I work. So that's what the book is about. It's about old guy learning from younger people new ways to follow Christ in a really turbulent time. So it's good to be back. I was listening this morning to Kate Coleman. How many of you were at the Eucharist? Okay, for those of you that weren't, Kate Coleman talked about being ambushed by culture. She talked about being blindsided. Have any of you been blindsided by events or traffic or anything? You've had that experience? To be honest, I get things wrong and I get blindsided all the time. And I'm trying out some material on you that I would not try out in the United States. To be honest, I was so looking forward to getting over here and getting away from the Tea Party and the polarizing and all of the nonsense that's a part of my culture. Yeah, it's a very difficult time to be a Yank because it really gets crazy what they do with the end times stuff. So it's good to be back here. And we're going to talk about being blindsided. And we're going to talk about side sight. And I'm going to cover a lot of material very, very quickly. But at the end, we're going to invite you in groups of 3 to 4 to talk about it and talk about where the terror is in doing community, where the promise is, but also to feel free to challenge and really have at me at the end. We'll have back and forth, and so we'll leave some time for that. So we're going to get some things going. When I travel without Christine, my friends that know me here, I have the gift of disorientation, and I head out for one place, and I wind up in another. You know the Taizé community? I did pilgrimage to the Taizé community. I had a 10-minute walk to catch the bus, to catch the train, to go to Madrid. I gave myself a half an hour. 2.5 hours later, I was wandering the countryside of southern France, meeting some lovely cows, and realized I'd gotten something desperately wrong. Retraced my steps. I turned right when I should have turned left. Eventually made it. You know, I missed the train, missed the bus, but I eventually got to Madrid. But if I'd been traveling with Christine, I never would have met those beautiful cows in the south of France. So there's always, so if I get a little lost or something, we're going to cover a lot of material. Bear with me. Help me. We need to kind of work on this together because I'm trying out stuff that I haven't used before. And because of the political tone in the States, where free market capitalism, for many of my evangelical friends, is the beginning of their Christian worldview, a kind of Darwinian approach to free market economics, if you know what I'm talking about. So we're going to try some stuff out here, and we're going to, well, the last time I was here, I can't figure out if it was 2001, 2002, but it was right as the United States was invading Iraq, and of course, Tony Blair involved you guys in that situation as well, and there was a lot of talk about Pax Americana and the U.S. as empire. I think our day in the sun is quickly being eclipsed with the rise of the Chinese economy that's just gone to second place. And I think I'm going to suggest there's another empire that we need to be concerned about that America is certainly a part of, and that's the global economy. And this would not go down well in my country, and I welcome some pushback on that. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to try to do 3 things very quickly. I'm going to talk about living in the shadow of the empire. And part of what I do for those of the, how many have suffered with me before? Okay. For those of you who have, I try to make sense of the future. So I'm going to do something that church people don't do nearly enough, contextual forecasting. How is the global economy, the demographics in England, the economy for the under 40 going to change in the next 10, 15 years? And a lot of people read and get informed. Church leaders in my country read about this. When I was here in 08, I spoke to the Council of the Evangelical Alliance and told them I thought there was a possibility of a global recession coming, September of 08. I don't think I was convincing. In the States, I worked with doing brainstorming sessions with leaders in Seattle, and they came up with whole new approaches to get ready for a possible recession, though I don't think they believed it either, including a church Craigslist, that is an online list who has an extra car, room in their house, because the Deacons Fund didn't go very far, the little bit of money that churches have to give to those at the margins. We need new imagination. The reason we're going to do some futuring is to imagine new ways to live, raise kids, do family,
and be God's compassion in a world in which I don't think the stormy times and the volatility is going to go away anytime soon. So we're going to, number one, we're going to talk about living in the shadow of the empire and something of the changing context. Your notes will help you if you got a handout sheet. And then we're going to talk briefly about rediscovering the new world that is already here, that N.T. Wright talks about in his third volume in Surprised by Hope. Shane Claiborne talks about in another way. And then we're going to talk about imagination. And if nothing else is accomplished, I hope I challenge you with your friends, with your mate, in your family, in your church, to discover the possibility of imagination, imagining new ways to serve God in a changing world. So that's kind of where we're headed. Let me just start. Some of you know the book Mustard Seed versus McWorld that I did in 99. I think that's what I was talking about last time, about globalization. We've moved into a new neighborhood, and that's what I talked about when I was here. A new neighborhood when the Berlin Wall came down, the Soviet Union imploded, and we've been knit together in a way that we never have before. This is a new economy. And Friedman said two things about the new global economy. Nobody's in charge, and nobody knows how it works. And we're finding that out with the troubles in Europe, with your economy. We're waiting for Osborne to come out with the white paper to figure out how bad it's going to be for your lives, your communities, your family. So it's a happening and a changing world. The only thing that I'm sure of as I look at the future is the volatility is not going to go away anytime soon. And I'm encouraging churches in my country to help people reinvent their lives, to reduce their economic vulnerability, to increase their availability to be God's compassion in times like this. We're going to have to help our people reimagine how to live. And there's a lot going on in the UK in terms of stewardship. In fact, you're much more globally aware, internationally aware, fair-traded products you've had in your churches for decades. Americans are just discovering fair-traded products. You have tremendous resource, but it's time to reimagine how to live and serve God. So that's part of what we're talking about. Let me just go down the laundry list of what I think this means. First of all, for the global poor, we need to pray for the people in Pakistan, 20 million people dispossessed. I worked in Haiti for 7 years for World Concern. Even though the earthquake is over, the suffering isn't. They're still trying to reimagine and rebuild. We're going to need to do more to help our neighbors. I was working with Tim Costello. Do you know that name? He's World Vision Australia. And when I was with them last year, Christine and I were there, he said that his research indicates that climate change is causing more weather-related disasters to the point that by the end of this decade, World Vision Australia will have to increase funding 4 to 5-fold for disaster reliefs in the tropical areas. And that's partly a result of our SUV lifestyles in the States. Do you understand? We're in this together. That's what we understand from environmentalism. And so clearly we're going to need to do more to really work with the MICA call to make poverty history. But right now I'm not encouraged because we're headed into a peak oil, peak water future where we're going to face new crises. And because fertilizers are petrochemically based, if we see oil double in price, which could happen within 10 to 15 years after China's appetite increases again, that's going to cause a possible food crisis. So all of this, I don't have time to unpack all of that, except we're going to need to do more, but I'm not sure that's going to be possible. The challenge is the Western poor, working with Livability yesterday, they're waiting for the Osborne paper because 97% of their funding to help those in need in Great Britain comes from the government, and they don't know what the bad news is going to be yet. But part of what we're talking about when we come back is becoming creative Christian scroungers, doing more with less, finding underutilized resources, empty buildings, land, and finding ways to use that as a kingdom resource. Also, helping create ways to help the poor where you start businesses that do good while doing well. Do you understand? Social entrepreneurship. Because I think the church in the UK, like the church in North America and down under, is facing a funding crisis that I'll talk about more tomorrow in my new conspirators workshop. Because baby boomers, how many baby boomers do we have here? Okay, you guys have just started retiring. You're going to join the rest of us in the nursing home. We're going to have a welcome party for you. but it's going to tear the bottom out of the funding boat. The people that are paying the bills are those that are still around from my generation, silent generation, and you boomers. So I think we're facing a crisis in terms of the ability of the church to respond both to global and local needs. How many people, well, let me talk about the middle class for a minute. How many of you have friends or family that have been laid off from the recession? How many have had friends that are that have lost homes, foreclosures? Okay. I think we're going to be in this for a while, and so helping in your churches, pastors, please start classes to help people reimagine how to steward their lives. I do battle with tithe stewardship. I understand the Old Testament origins. I don't think it's New Testament. I think the call to follow Christ is a whole life call. And many Americans, they give 10% or some portion thereof, and then what they do with the rest is their own blankety-blank business, okay? We simply have to help people, and this is what we'll be talking about. Hear the call to whole life discipleship and stewardship. How many of you are under 40? Under 40, raise your hands. You're hitting this new global economy at a much tougher time than your parents or grandparents. There's an article in The Economist a few weeks back about how you guys are buying much few, you have many, many fewer of you are able to buy houses, and that's not likely to get better anytime soon. You're among the first generation in the United States, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Great Britain, many of whom will not have the lifestyles they were raised with. And nobody in our Christian colleges in America is kind of cluing people into that and seeing it as opportunity, because it's an opportunity to imagine new ways to live. You're all scripted to live out your parents' lifestyle. We all are. The problem is that dream has gotten much more expensive. University debt is much higher for your generation than any prior generation, and housing is much higher. My generation in the U.S., few of us spent over 20% of one income for rent or mortgage, 20% of one. Houses were a little smaller. Those same houses today are not cheap. Today, for most of you that live in cities, small towns, small villages, an exception, maybe 40-50% of two incomes. So stop and think about the stewardship implications for your life and your church. If you do the dream and try to live out your parents' lifestyle, some of you for 30 years are going to give half of your income away. That's going to be less time with your family and certainly less time with your neighbors. So one of the reasons to reimagine new ways of living, the single-family detached, semi-detached house did not come with the Ark of the Covenant. But part of where I think we've gotten sideswiped by culture is we do not recognize the extent that culture has its way with us and shapes our values. I was working in Lebanon just a couple months. Christine and I were there a couple months working with evangelical leaders that are doing international evangelism through television. And I got blindsided by people that I think were blindsided because I kept trying to talk about global consumerism. And you need to be concerned, as your Muslim cousins are, about the impact of the global economy on your kids, the values impact of telling them that their identity and self-worth is tied into this, the early sexual identity stuff that's being promoted now through all kinds of media. I said, this is stuff you need to, and I did that three or four times, and finally, an Arab brother who heads the Egyptian Bible Society, he's lived in Kenya, came up to me, says, Tom, he says, I know what you're saying about consumerism, the global economy. I agree with most of it, but you're not even going to get started because what it means to be an evangelical Christian in Lebanon and throughout the Middle East is to be Western and modern, for the husbands to drive the Mercedes-Benz and the kids to play with Barbie dolls. It's to totally submerge themselves in that culture with Jesus too. Does that sound familiar? Is it possible that we've been blindsided? In America, we tend to see the culture that we live in, the suburban communities of affluences we live in, as values neutral. They're just places where we live and cars that we drive, and there's not a recognition that they're very Eurocentric. They come out of a whole set of cultures that value individualism and privacy, and we're seeing something happen that's changing the character of our whole world. So let me just go on to this. The Western young, I encourage you guys to reimagine how to live and to come up with new ways to reduce cost, increase festivity, and we'll get there in a minute. But the global young are a particular concern because the global economy has them in their sights too. How many of you travel internationally? Have you noticed that teenagers from Morocco to the Philippines have more in common with teens in Britain and the US than the cultures they're a part of? They're all wearing the same clothes, drinking the same soda, watching the same MTV, into the same American Idol, because the global economy, the marketers of this new global economy, want people to buy their wares. They're not just marketing goods. They're trying to convince people everywhere that their identity, self-worth, is based on buying into the marketplace notion of cool. It's like these guys own the patent right to cool. And so it's changing culture. This is what churches call evangelism. And it's really creating a global youth culture. And I don't find people involved in mission helping those young people decode the messages are indeed our own. Let me use another word that we Anglicans use. I go to an Episcopal church in Seattle. I'm kind of an Anabaptist Anglican, if you can figure that out. I like Stuart Murray a lot, and so I'll refer to that. But I think what's going on through the marketplace is formation. And I find a lot of church people think that on our Sunday morning, we're the ones that are doing formation with our young, and that's a joke. With all the formation that's happening through the media, the press, the brilliant sophistication, they're gathering so much material. Every time we use the internet, every time we shop, there go my notes. That's a great breeze. Chaos. Thank you. See, this is an experience of community. That's lovely. I just have to find the one that I'm on. I might ask one of you to take over. You've got yours paperclip, so be ready. Okay. Yeah, I think we're good to go. Little by little and step by step. Okay. Okay, there we are. We're going to protect them now. And so we're facing a daunting global changing context. And because the needs of the poor and the needs of the poor in the UK as well as internationally are going to be increasing, we need to do more. The middle class, though, is declining. The church in the UK is declining. I'll talk more about that tomorrow in terms of the actual percentages. Giving is going to decline. And we're going to be under growing pressure. I think there are a lot of reasons to imagine new ways of living together, to reduce cost. And for stormy times, you're going to need your mates. One of the things that happened during the American recession is the poor did much better in some ways because they got together as community. They knew how to work together in hard times. The people in the suburbs just suffered. They didn't know who their neighbors were, and they weren't able to get it together. Well, now, what I'm going to do is use some new language based upon what I described in Lebanon. I think the global economy is taking on some of the characteristics of empire, and bear with me here. In terms of what Kate was sharing this morning, I think we've been blindsided. In my culture, we tend to see the global economy as just a neutral economic mechanism. We don't recognize that it has enormous value. The Western progress myth, neoliberalism, is trying to convince people all over the planet that the ultimate in human experience is defined principally in economic terms. No people of faith, Muslim, Jewish, or Christian, have ever believed that. The essence of human society is not found in the economic growth of a society, of a people, or of a family. Okay, don't we? We know that, don't we? And so that message and the kind of formation that's going on, I find very, very concerning. And all of the empires from Babylon to Rome have sought to define what reality is. And let me be gentle here, but in the affluent suburbs, many live in the suburbs, but particularly in the affluent suburbs, I think it's exceeding difficult for people to be countercultural. The kids have to dress alike, look alike. They have the ski slopes on the same weekend. You have to keep your garage doors shut and drive certain kinds of cars. The pressure to conformity is unrelenting and unremitting. Now, that's not to say people in the suburbs can't create communities, but I think it will take communities where we can support one another to do something that is marching to a different drumbeat. And so I think we've got some work to do. And here's the problem. I think the problem is that those of us who take Scripture seriously, Anglicans, Evangelicals, Baptists, all of us hold a high view of Scripture. But the problem is we tend to bring it to bear just on our spiritual values and our moral values. We never, in my culture, we never bring it to bear on cultural values. I know of any number of older Presbyterian couples my age in Seattle that tear up relationships they formed over 30 to 40 years in the Seattle community to buy a one-bedroom condo in Arizona and to live lavishly the last few years of their life, not even enough space for family to visit. There is no forum in any of their Presbyterian churches to talk about what is the good life in retirement. That is purely dictated by class and income. You don't mess with what's parked in the parking lot or where people live. Do you know what I'm talking about? We don't have any forums as young people are starting out to talk about what are the biblical values we need to develop for how we house, where we live. We're moving into a new majority future in which the U.S. is going to be the first non-European Western country by 2040. Most people in the church do not know that. Most young Americans starting out are still heading for monocultural suburban communities. The last place to be raising kids are going to live in the 21st century. So we need to think about doing formation and how to bring Scripture to bear on cultural values. Does that make any sense? Are you with me there? It's a different kind. I've never been a part of a Bible study group ever where we've ever brought, you know, we focus on relationships, getting along with the boss at work, problems with the family, spiritual and moral issues, never defining some guidelines for how we do our cultural life. And I guess I just want to say I don't think we can let class and income dictate that anymore. If we're going to be whole life disciples of Christ, then we have the opportunity to imagine a whole new way of being and a whole new way of living. So where do we begin with that? Where we begin with that is to go back to the Bible and the kind of writing. How many have read Surprised by Hope? For those of you who haven't, it's a terribly important book. N.T. Wright spoke at Seattle Pacific University in 2005 to a group of faculty at a luncheon. He stood up, and the first thing he said was, and it stopped, it arrested everybody in the room. He said, "Heaven is not my home. Heaven is not my home. Heaven is where the future of God is kept, but it's not my home." And then he went on to talk about a vision of coming home as a great bodily resurrected community to a new heaven and a new earth. That's different imagery. Where I've been blindsided as a young person, wasn't raised in the church, but I was nurtured in evangelical college by an eschatology that talked about the future of God. The Australian question is, what is God on about? It's a really good question. And the answer I was raised with is rescuing disembodied souls for a non-material something up there. Come Monday morning, for Western Christians in the UK, down under in the States, two different images of the better future. Getting a piece of the rock while this getting still good, you know, all the pressure and seduction of the career and the economy. Getting disembodied souls when things go really, really bad. Which one is more compelling come Monday morning? Getting a piece of the rock or waiting for soul rescue? Clearly, it's getting a piece of the rock. The passivity of eschatology. We need an eschatology that gives us a new reason to get out of bed Monday morning. Something that's compelling, that's breathtaking, that calls us beyond ourselves. And the good news of the gospel is, in this imagery of a great resurrected future, it isn't just middle-class Brits and Americans getting a spiritual part changed and being taken to heaven. It's imagery of God transforming a world. It's imagery of healing finally coming to the broken. It's imagery of justice coming to the poor. It's imagery of peace coming to the nations. It's a reason to get out of bed Monday morning. The hope of God being involved through the resurrected Christ in making all things new. It isn't just about me and my comfortable family in the suburbs, but about a world that Christ died for. Somehow we need that imagination. Shane Claiborne gives us some new language that's non-theological. My problem with theological language is that we tend to put it in the God box and it doesn't affect our cultural lives. Shane's got three one-liners. Another world is possible out of the anti-globalization movement. Another world is necessary, also true. But the third one is the killer. In the risen Christ, another world is already here. Another world is already here. So it's how to live into, celebrate into, and become a part of that new world. Not 15 minutes in the morning in church when you can make it on the weekends, but reimagining a whole life faith that's more festive, more celebrative, but it's a part of making expression to a very different dream for the global future than the one that's at the center of the global economy. Do you understand? We need to be counter-empire. We need to be counter-cultural. And that's where I find the monasticism movement in the United States. The earliest monasticism movement was begun by a Kiwi by the name of Viv Grigg. Servants with the poor, Asian servants with the poor. It didn't begin with Shane. But they call us to counter-cultural change, as Stuart Murray does. And we need a monasticism that's not just about liturgy and rhythm. We need both. But we need something that moves us in some whole new directions. Now, I'm looking for page 4, but it's not your page 4. I have to use bigger print so I can see what I'm doing here, so bear with me. So, very quickly then, how does God invite us wherever we are, whether we're retired, raising kids, getting started? How does God call us to be a part of something new? Well, let me just talk briefly about whole life discipleship and stewardship first. How many have heard of a book called Purpose Driven Life? Okay. Christy and I actually wrote a book that came out 3 months before that called Living on Purpose. But no worries, we're not afflicted by 22 million sales. Okay. Here's the easiest entry point we could find of helping people find their way into a whole life faith where we could live into, serve into, and celebrate into that new world that is already here. Here's the starting point, and I find Baptists and Anglicans all agree on this theology. Everyone is called, not just pastors and missionaries. Do you believe that? Everyone's called? Well, if we believe that, then why in the world don't we create a discernment process in our churches, in small groups, to help people discern their calling? And that's what our little Living on Purpose book is. I brought 5 copies across because it's not available here anymore. It's simply helping people. Here's what we're suggesting. It's not very complicated. In small groups, helping people help one another discern and write down, how am I hearing God call me through Scripture? That's a good starting place, isn't it? How am I hearing God call me through prayer? The needs of others. Jesus Christ is thinly disguised in the poor and the suffering. What tears at my heart that could be God's call on my life? And how is God calling me not only through my giftedness, but my brokenness? And out of what you write down, simply to help everyone formulate a beginning calling statement that has something to do with using your life to make a difference. And then our 40 days is helping people reinvent their time styles and lifestyles to live into their calling statement, to be community, helping people begin the journey into more of a whole life. Comprendez-vous? Are you with me? Okay. So that's a beginning point and starting to reimagine. Part of the journey then is finding community, because we desperately need people to be with us. And one of the things that started during the end of the charismatic house church movement that was really important in Britain was the cell group movement. How many have been a part of cell groups? Well, that's a beginning point. And for the stormy times ahead, we need to at least be a part of small cell groups where we're nurtured, loved, and held accountable and help people find their vocation. So on a continuum of community, there are cell groups. There is another step called proximity communities. And then there are residential models, from Jesus Army to co-housing, and I'm going to go down through those very quickly so we can get into discussion groups to just give you a sense of what that's like. Another model that's close to the cell group model at St. Thomas Sheffield is the Order of Mission, where people bonded together, and it's a little more missionally focused. I think that's a great idea. In San Francisco, there's a group that Mark Scandretz started called Reimagine. And what they did was to get a number of people, 40 or 50 people, to all move together into the same neighborhood in the Mission District in San Francisco. When I was working with Phil and Wendy Wall and Russell and Charlotte Rook at the beginnings of the Raines Park Church, I encouraged them to buy an apartment house in Raines Park, which was really relatively inexpensive, and condoize it and open one apartment as a place to work with people from the streets and as a place to do community. It would have been in reach then. They didn't have a lot of money, so it wasn't their fault. But hey, they knew some people that did. That's still within reach of finding some place like that. The Jesus Army has been strong, and it's part of that whole first wave of community. It's still around. We have Jesus People USA in Chicago, Reba Place, that are a part of that. Residential communities that are particularly interesting, Viv Griggs' community that I mentioned, there's a place in Australia that we were with last year called Urban Neighbors of Hope. They live residentially in communities of poverty in Bangkok, Melbourne, and Sydney. And they live at the same economic level. They have a rule of life. They have serious spiritual practices. But living at the same economic level, that's setting the bar a little high. How many of you read Shane's book? Okay. A lot of middle-class Americans read that. They really get their shoes challenged off, but they're not ready to move into his neighborhood in Philadelphia. Do you know what I'm talking about? They're not ready for that. There's something going on in Britain, but it has more visibility in the United States, called co-housing. Co-housing was invented in Denmark 40 years ago by people that weren't even religious. They figured out that detached and semi-detached living is not necessarily the best way of life. So you need to check it on the site. It's on your back sheet. There's a bibliography, because people at Greenbelt really get angry if they don't get a homework assignment. And so you've got a lot to read there afterwards, and you'll find the co-housing site on the back, cohousing.org in the States. Essentially, they build, it's like a condo where everybody's got their own private space. It's none of the terror of communes. You've got a two-bedroom, three-bedroom, but there's no backyard and front yard. There's one area where all the kids play together, and there's another area where everybody gardens together, and they're really big on sustainability values. Now, doesn't that read like the Book of Acts, mutual care? What if we started living into that instead of the isolated autonomy of our Eurocentric lifestyles that are going to get too expensive for a lot of you younger folks, to have your own flat, to have your own house? And I think there are new possibilities of doing that. Let me tell you about two. One is in inner city Oakland. 12 years ago, a group of people going to a Methodist church in inner city Oakland lived in Berkeley. They wanted to live in the community where they went to church. That's cool. And so they bought a quarter acre with two old houses, raised them up and added a level underneath, built seven new houses, put solar on the rooftop, water on demand water, very high creation care value. They are now a stop on the Berkeley Green Tour, because they sell their electricity back to the utility during the summer months. And the last time I checked, they just pay $5 a month for all of their electric needs, including heating their homes, because of that kind of creativity. But when they moved into this community, they didn't put their kids in private Christian schools or do religious homeschooling. They put them in Emerson Elementary, that wasn't a particularly good school for primarily African-American kids. And then they flooded it with volunteers for all the kids who were there. Isn't that something of the shalom of God? Isn't that something of living into that world that is already here? They put on block parties, art installations. They're part of that neighborhood. They're invested in that neighborhood. The other model near us is up in Silverdale, Bartimaeus Community. They built 25 units on 7 acres, and because they cluster together, they have a 3.5-acre woodland park. The last house they sold was a 2-bedroom, bath and a half for $157 US, and you get the park and a common building. They always have a common building where you have meals together a couple times a week. So we need to have the same imagination that green architects do, to imagine and design whole new ways of living and being. And to do all of this, how many have remember Ron Sider's book, Rich Christians and Age of Hunger? Well, that book was so influential over here, certainly influential in my life and Christine's life. But what we're talking about is not doing a simpler version of the Western dream or the American dream. We're talking about reinventing it and creating a way of life that's less stressed, more festive, but where we free up more time and resource to be a part of that good news that is already here. So part of what we do, I love what the emerging church is doing in terms of imaginary worship, but I'd like to see them get it out of the worship box whenever they meet and bring it into our homes, into our communities. How many know the film Babette's Feast? Okay, for those of you that don't know, we do an Advent celebration every year called Advent 2 Homecoming that images the great bodily resurrected multicultural community coming home. So this year we chose Babette's Feast. We have some Mennonites that own a historic old mansion there. It's a B&B. They can seat 18. We had 18 people, including some young church planters. We watched Babette's Feast. For those of you that haven't seen it, it's a beautiful film about this older guy that's running essentially a house church in a Scandinavian country. He dies. His daughters, single daughters, try to keep the show on the road. People start to get at each other. You've never seen that in your church, I know. But that started to come unraveled. As they were trying to pull things together, a woman appears at the door from France. She said, "Can I come in and cook for you?" They said, "We have no money." She said, "I don't need money. I need safety. I've lost my husband. I've lost my son. I'm at risk." They let her come in. She fixes food. She buys a lotto ticket every single year with the little bit she has. She wins the lotto. And it's the anniversary of the 100th day since the founder of this community was born. So they're going to have a celebration. She insists on fixing the food for the celebration over the resistance of the two daughters. When they come into the room that night, they're overwhelmed. They're used to boiled potatoes and white bread, and here's this huge, lavish display. This woman has spent the whole fortune, every single bit of that, on this single meal. And so the question was, where is the kingdom of God? Where is the good news? It's in the extravagant grace and generosity of God. It's in the goodness of this woman who, in a very Christ-like way, gave everything she had. It's in relationships being reconciled as people finally start to eat and taste the banquet. We don't just have to do the Western dream and the American dream and work church in around the weekend. We can create whole new ways of being. We can do better than reality television and American Idol. We can create our own ways to party into, celebrate into, and live into, and it's much easier in community. I'm the cook. I'm the hospitality guy in our community. I'd much rather be cooking for you than up here speaking at you. I love to cook food from all over the world for friends from all over the world, and I wouldn't trade hearing the noise of the kids upstairs to live in an age-segregated facility, you know, where we're comparing our walkers and bed sores. It's not something that I want to do, okay? We can all reimagine new ways of living and being. So the question is, where are you at in terms of the conversation? Given the fact that we're in a world that's changing, Christians, simply, we all have to reimagine how to live. Could you begin to imagine, at least small groups, could you imagine something residential like co-housing that isn't moving in with Shane Claiborne, that's in a more suburban community? What's within reach? Or is this sheer terror? Or I'm talking utter rubbish. And I'm glad to hear you talk to me, you know, stuff that you don't agree with. Find 2 to 3 other friends, and let's take a few minutes. How are you responding to the call to reimagine how to live and follow Christ in a changing world in the shadow of an empire that would very much like to define for you what's important and what's of value? Find a friend, find a mate, introduce yourself.
He wants the names and email addresses.
Atención. Perdóname, señores. Venga usted, por favor. Here we go. People are already starting communities. There are 3 families that have already moved in together. I'm just making that up. They're handing out sheets. I'm supposed to do this at the beginning. Christine's going to be really upset with me. We have a monthly e-zine newsletter where we talk about stuff in the future and imaginative new ways that people are responding. The one that we'll send you is one on the changing economy and how people in England and elsewhere are creating new ways to do stewardship in tough times. They're free. There's no attached anything. Just put your name and your email address on there, and we will get it to you. I'm going to have a young man, where did he go? He's right here. Here's somebody that's already taken initiative to make a beginning. Maybe this will encourage somebody. Tell us your name and where you're doing it.
My name's Sam Stevens. I'm from London, from Hammersmith. And what I'm going to tell you about is actually working internationally, although it's probably working best in London currently. And I think we're just beginning to hit a sort of tipping point. The idea is, the backstory is this. I became good friends with my downstairs neighbours through lending things. I think I knocked on their door and I asked them for some chairs for a dinner that I was having. And then they asked me for some milk. And in time, we became really good friends, and we took the walls of our garden down. I have to admit, they did most of the gardening. And then from there, I was cycling down the road one day, and I saw someone with some hedge trimmers. And I thought to myself, I really would love to borrow your hedge cutters, but I just don't have the courage to ask you. And I'm pretty brazen. I'll go up to most people, but I just didn't have any relationship with them. And I got talking to a friend of mine who had created something called Christian Flatshare, an accommodation sharing website. And out of it, we created something called streetbank.com. And it's a website where you go on, you put in your postcode, you put in one thing that you'd be willing to lend or give away, or a skill that you'd be willing to share. And it shows you everything within 1,000 yards that your neighbors have put on. So in where I live, there's nearly 300 people who are members, but everyone has their own unique circle. So wherever you are in the country, I'd encourage you to go on and see what your neighbors have put on, and hopefully we'll create an online community that will actually get people actually sharing in real life. Thanks very much.
Okay. Yeah, let's give them a hand. Just pass it back. I forgot, I mentioned disorientation in the beginning. I didn't finish the story about Babette's Feast. One of the things that I've learned from your emerging church planters, they don't want to just understand it, faith intellectually. They're postmoderns. They want to experience it. And so I mentioned I like to cook. I've never cooked French before. And I spent all day cooking for these 18 people. And we had a wild mushroom soup with chanterelle mushrooms, goat cheese salad, half a stuffed pheasant, French wines, French coffee, French chocolate, wonderful food. And we spent the rest of the evening living into the celebration of what we saw on the screen in terms of kingdom. Okay, what are some other things you've been talking about? Ideas of doing things new, if you have fears, challenges to the global economy as empire. What are some of the things you've been talking about? Anybody else starting something new? Looking for some mates?
Hi there. We moved out of Bristol and we ended up buying a small holding down in Devon. What we really wanted to do was give people an opportunity to not just get on a mortgage treadmill, which I felt was becoming onerous for people, especially as things got more expensive and families just couldn't stop to look after their children. They were tied into a system which was sort of anti-Christian. And so we bought this small holding as a means of trying to give people a way out, a reason to stop and reimagine how their lives might be and what track their lives might want to be on. But actually, it's hitting the ground, it's really hard because if you get a property of enough space for people to live in, it's very expensive. And so you're burdening a community already with the costs
right.
of housing them. Or you do what we do, and then you're sort of stuck with
We've got room inside. Come on inside. Sorry. Poor people are being rained to death. Yeah, and the mortgage, have you found a different way to do the mortgage scheme? Because there are several groups that are creating alternative mortgages to reduce the interest rate. Is that part of what you're doing? Okay. I forgot to mention also our Celtic Echo community. We are headed towards building something for a group of maybe 30 people living on the land, very sustainability, but also with a rhythm of life, a rule of life, a counterpoint to our little urban mustard seed house. And I'm happy to talk to you at the book signing or any place else you catch me. I'm going to be around until the end of the festival. Others on this side, some of the new possibilities or fears? Yes, down here.
Hey, we were just trying to figure out how to go about starting a community ourselves, and we're thinking through a lot of possibilities. And one of the things that just keeps coming up that seems to kind of get in the way is, like, what do you do about financing, getting some place to live? How does a group of people come together to buy something? Sort of what's the financial way of doing that, how can a group of people get a mortgage, or how can people sort of be free to move in and out, if commitments take them somewhere else, for example. And just trying to think through how do we actually make people free as part of that.
One of the things since the co-housing movement has been going since
for 40 years in the U.S. and not that long in Britain, they've got a whole rhythm that you go through. And like Mennonites and Quakers, they use a consensus model. So everybody that's a part of one of these co-housing experimental communities have to be involved in each design step and getting the resource and going to the bank. And it's kind of a slow process. But people my age love these communities because in the U.S., if you're aged and you become disabled and you're in the suburbs, you're toast. There's nobody in most of our suburban communities that do anything. But in these communities, people shop for you. They help you with their chores, and they start to work like extended families. One of the things that's starting to happen, social change in America, because of the economy, many middle-class people that have come to love the autonomy of the nuclear lifestyle are becoming intergenerational extended family communities again out of economic necessity. I worked as a social worker in East San Jose in other days, and 15 to 19 people would be in a three-bedroom house. And it's not that state yet for middle-class people, but we're going to be forced into community, many of us, if we don't choose it. And so this is an opportune time to choose, and there's not just one way. What I'm encouraging is a range of experimental communities. That's why we're still trying to create stuff, even though I'm older. We need a range of new experiments. What I'm really encouraging in the U.S., instead of building yet another luxury dorm, because I don't know if your Christian colleges in America have these elaborate food courts. There's one that's actually imported a French pastry chef. I'm not sure how this is going to prepare young people for mission. They have to pay the bill for luxury dorms and food courts. I'm trying to get them to build co-housing communities that are intergenerational, multicultural, where they grow some of their own food, learn about sustainability and a living learning. People need to check it out. In other days, there was a community in Australia called the Community of the Gentle Bunyip, imaginary little animal looking for its lost spouse. They had Monk of the Month Club. Monk of the Month Club, you could come and stay a couple weeks or a couple months to see if it was really as terrifying as you thought it would be to live in community. Well, let's get one more. We're just about at time. One more. Thank you for your good work. And do look at the resource sheet on the back. You'll find, and in my book, The New Conspirators, there's a lot more descriptions of other forms of community. Please.
Hi there. My wife and I live in Oxford, and I'm just thinking that there could be people that don't want to move out of their house, but they could have people move into their house.
Sure.
We live in a Finnish summer cottage in someone's backyard in Oxford. Uh-huh. We use their kitchen. We pay them cheaper rent than anyone else in Oxford, which more than covers the cost of us being there. We garden for them. We will hopefully babysit for them. We're now like family with them.
Wonderful.
So it's just a different model again, but it's brilliant.
Well, that does sound brilliant. And one of the other things in Oxford, one of the other residential communities, because I found very little since Jesus Army. When I came here in 78 for the first time, there were a number of residential communities, and Jesus Army is about all I can find, except in Oxford Christian Mission Society. Johnny Baker bought a house there, and people are living in community and starting to do something that's neo-monastic, and that's one of the few residential experiments. Last chance, anybody else? This will be the last one, then I'll say a prayer, and then we're out of here, and I'd love to talk to you at the bookstore or wherever.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's actually more of a question. That's okay. My wife and I, we don't live in community, but we're very interested in learning it and exploring that possibility of future. But we do have some friends and relatives who do live in community and are doing amazing things. And in many ways are very far ahead of us with sort of sustainable living and sharing their lives and all that sort of stuff. However, I think most of them probably wouldn't describe themselves as Christian. And actually some of them I think would be quite anti-church. So if their challenge to us is, we're doing this stuff that you're interested in, but why do we need the church or Jesus? How could you answer that?
That's a good question. The emerging church talks about belonging before believing. And the community that I mentioned, Bartimaeus Community Silverdale, there are some non-believers in that community. But they find ways to be family together over the top and around the edges of that. And we're going to have to find all kinds of collaborations. But what we need most of all is for people to embody something that looks much more like the kingdom of God than an upper middle class privileged lifestyle where you make it to church once in a while when you're not on holiday. Because in the States right now, regular church attendance for many has dropped to once a month. In Australia, it's once every 3 weeks. And it's because they're involved in a different dream and a different story. And God, who has always, always, always been a part of our story, invites us with every part of our being to become a part of God's story that has a very different outcome and a very different goal than the story of the global economy. So it's a time of invitation. It's a time of imagination. I pray, God, it's a time of new beginnings. And anybody that wants to do community, that's thinking about, seriously, come up to the stage afterwards. The other group doesn't get here until 3 o'clock. Let me say a quick prayer. Creator God, in the name of the risen Christ, we thank you for the compassion, the love, the gospel that I've seen over many years in the church in the UK. I've learned so much. I've been challenged deeply. And these are different times, though. And I pray you'll help us in a changing world and a changing church to discover how we can more faithfully be followers of Jesus Christ, not just church on Sunday, but with all of our lives. Spirit of the living God, blow through our imaginations and help us to imagine whole new ways to follow you and to be something of your compassion in this troubled world. In Christ's name, amen. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord.